Let's talk about lab report number two first, the TLC experiment. So as it states on the website, the new due date for this will be November 1st. So a week from today. Just to let you know, for the next two experiments, lab three will not actually be due for a while, because I might end up making that the one exception for the way we do lab reports. It might be the one lab where I have you discuss a small amount of theory. And because of that, I don't want to have that lab report due until we have hit that topic officially in lecture, which is that's what all these lectures are building up to. And although technically we could use that overview lecture I gave you last week to handle most of the compounds that you had to test, still, I'd rather wait until you have had the full coverage of that topic. So lab report three is just on hold for the moment until we get to that point in lecture. Lab report four, though, will be very easy, very direct to explain. So it will be due on time, which we're starting lab four today. The second lab period will be on Thursday. The next lab period after that will be Tuesday of next week. And so two lab periods from that will be 2 weeks from today. That's when lab report four will be due. Now for lab report two, let's go over the format. Purpose. What would you say might have been a good purpose for this experiment? Remember that we don't refer to the fact we're learning TLC in our purpose statements. So based on what we did do, though, what would you say would be a reasonable purpose statement? Identify the unknowns in some sample using TLC. So you have either the analgesic mixture or you have the tablet that you crushed up that should have produced one or more spots. It was not an incorrect result if you had multiple things show up for your analgesic tablet, because you'd expect possibly to see multiple components in that tablet. So you had the five compounds, the reference compounds that you tested just to get an established value for, this RF value that I'll cover again how to calculate. And then you're comparing those individual spots to those spots that you get from the unknown. And if you can make a match, then we're going to say that you've identified a particular component of that unknown. So for data, what forms of data did you collect? We didn't collect RF directly. That is what we're going to calculate. But the distances we did measure. And there were several things that we measured distances for. First, for each TLC plate that you ran, you have the solvent front distance, which, since there was some confusion in the other sections, let me draw a picture again of what a TLC plate might have looked like. So for many of you, after you ran the TLC plate, where the solvent front was, you might have had kind of a dark line that ran all the way across. And that might have been because the solvent dissolved some kind of impurities, some kind of contamination that might have been in that development chamber. And those impurities went along for the ride, you could say. That solvent front you need to mark down, because distance can be different on each TLC plate. But if you ran the same type of TLC plate under the same conditions, then the relative distance, this ratio, this RF we're going to calculate, should be reproducible. But in order to get that ratio, you have to know how far the solvent traveled. So you don't measure from the bottom of the plate. You measure from the starting line, because that's where the solvent first encountered the spots. So the distance from that solvent, from the starting line, to the solvent front, that is the solvent distance. Then, measuring from the starting line again, up to where one of your dots was, that would be the compound distance. And so for data, I'd say that you have the solvent distance, or since many of you used multiple TLC plates, you'll have solvent distances. And you'd need that value for each plate. You then have your compound distances. For each reference compound. And then you have your unknown distance or distances. You report one distance for each spot that you saw for that unknown on your TLC plate. Now, can you think of any other forms of data that you might have acquired during this experiment? So some of you pointed out that you had dots that seemed to glow under the UV lamp. Some of you saw a purple glow to your spot. If you saw that same purple glow in one of your reference compounds and then in your unknown, then that's a good piece of evidence that you had that particular reference compound as part of your unknown. So color is a sort of backup guide you could use for identification. Now, I didn't originally plan for it today because I thought we were going to run out of time, but we still do need to do the stain. So at this point, we'll need to do it Thursday since we'll have plenty of open time on Thursday to do it. I advise you go ahead and start working on your lab reports now because you'll be able to do 90-95% of your lab report and just use that color as one last thing that you slip in. This is not as strong a recommendation I need to make for this section. I was more worried about the Monday-Wednesday sections because we do have various forms of Halloween parties over the weekend. So knowing that you might have that as part of your social activities, but then you have this lab report due and your lab quiz is next week, is it not? So don't wait till the night before to start your lab report when you're going to have to be panicking about your lab quiz. Go ahead and start on it now. But back to this, color of the dots could be one other form of data that you acquired. If you didn't do it, no problem. Because did anybody have any spots for the reference compounds that failed to show up under UV light? So just a couple of you all, and unfortunately that might have meant that you just had problems spotting it. But since otherwise all the spots showed up, I'm just crossing my fingers that we don't have any surprises that will show up by the TLC stain, that will just again be sort of a confirmation of colors. Now, any other forms of data, though, that you acquired? No, because everything else was done according to the procedure. So if we cared about procedure, we'd note what was the solvent mix that we used, what type of TLC plates that we use. So really, we can move on then to calculations. Which there is only one type of calculation that you're going to do for this report. So just like we had done last time, if we do have one type of equation we're going to use over and over again, we need to write the equation out once, which for RF, that would be the compound distance divided by the solvent distance. Since none of the spots traveled as far as the solvent front, all of your values should be less than one. So you write out the equation once, you show your calculations once, and then just make a table of all your RF values. Now again, like what we did with the first experiment, it would make sense if for your data section, you were creating a table where you had the distances that each spot traveled. It would be kind of logical right next to it, another column, to put those RF values. So that is mingling your data and your calculations, but it is exactly the type of recommendation I made last time. And Since it is so logical, you can mix your data and calculations when you're making a nice overview table like that. Just make sure that you keep your working of the calculation in the calculations section. Now, a question that might come up is, well, how do I determine what this distance is? Because since this was the first time that most of you had done TLC plates before, you might have inadvertently ended up with spots that were huge in your developed TLC plates. So where do you measure the spot? Generally, you measure right in the middle. Of course, if you did have such a huge spot like this, that means that you don't have a high degree of confidence in what your RF value is. So if you're unable to identify your unknowns, or you're not sure about the identities, then one of the things that you might put in your discussion section is the fact that these spots ended up so large. Now, before we get to discussion, though, there is going to be the conclusion statement that's in between, which, if the purpose of this lab was to determine the components of an unknown mixture, then your conclusion statement will just be the components of the unknown mixture are, and then list them. Or if there's only one, is. Or, as some of you might discover, you might have spots in your unknown that don't match any of the reference compounds. And that can happen if we fail to give you a wide enough range of references. I seem to remember that we used to have 6 in the past instead of 5. So if you do have one spot that does not match with your unknown, it is perfectly reasonable to say there was a component of the unknown that could not be identified. If I didn't give you that reference compound, you can't be penalized for not identifying it. But you should then report what happened. So your conclusion statement may say something like this. The unknown tablet contained both acetaminophen and caffeine, along with a component that could not be identified based on RF values. For example. Now for the discussion section. Some of you still have this worry that if your lab report does not cause shoulder damage when you hold it because it's not long enough, that somehow that you're not going to get a good grade for that report. It's kind of the opposite. The more that students tend to ramble on in the discussion section, you might have really great ideas, but then you throw some bad ones in as well. Chem 1A, that's much more frequent just because you don't have as much chemical knowledge. But for example, if you started saying something like, well, the TLC plate might not have developed correctly because maybe the solvent mixture wasn't fully saturated because maybe I didn't have a good piece of filter paper, or the lid was left off too long, or the atmospheric pressure was changing while the lab was going on. I mean, you can come up with reasons why things didn't work, but unless you had some evidence that those things were affecting your results, don't mention them. Only mention the very specific sources of error you might have really had in your experiment. This one that I just showed you, that your spots might end up way too large, that's a reasonable form of error to report. So don't make things up. Don't worry about making a big, huge discussion section if you don't have anything to discuss. If your experiment went smoothly and you could identify your components, you don't need to discuss anything because any theory associated with an experiment, you're going to get on the lab quiz. So questions for lab report 2. All right, so now for experiment 3. How many of you do still need to measure out some of the alkyl halides for the SN1, SN2 experiment? Anybody need to? Just a few of you. So I'm going to ask if you could please do that right at the beginning of the period so that we can clean those up again and get those out of the way. One thing I noticed, Thursday of last week, is when we first did this experiment, I had mentioned something about putting the bottles up and making a kind of assembly line, where you just leave one pipette with one bottle, and then people process through that. As soon as I finished lab lecture last time, though, at least 6 of you had your own set of pipettes, and so we ended up with a whole mass of them in the waste bottle. Now, I don't know what happened in between the lab lecture and the lab itself that there was that disconnect. And I know that if I'm lecturing for an hour, that 1 minute out of that lecture, it's reasonable that you might have tuned out, but that is just unfortunately the wrong minute to tune out. So in the future, when I give you these directions, there's a reason for that. We ended up with a waste bottle just full of pipettes, and the more pipettes that are running around, I'm convinced, the more cross-contamination is going to occur. So for those of you using the alkyl halides today, here's how I'd like you to please do it. Put a few bottles in each fume hood. This is why I want you to do this at the beginning and try to do it safely but quickly so we don't interfere with anybody else's experiment space. Put one and only one pipette that is associated with just one bottle so we've reduced the possibility of cross-contamination, and please don't get your own individual pipettes so that we don't end up with a mass of them in the waste today. All right, so that's experiment three. Any questions about what you need to be doing with experiment three? Then let's talk about the new experiment that we're going to start and mostly complete today. Experiment number four. Before I actually go over experiment number four, I want to review the SN1 mechanism because we're going to see a lot of similarities between it and the mechanism for today's experiment. So, there are aspects of chemistry where no matter how creatively you might try to present it, there's still going to come a point where you just have to just memorize. But mechanisms, I don't recommend that you just memorize. You need to start to learn to identify common mechanistic patterns. For example, when we form carbocations, we're often going to form them in a similar way, or they may have similar reactivity. Functional groups may be different, the results might be different, but there still might be a very familiar pattern in that mechanism. So that's why I'm going to show you this SN1 mechanism so that we can better understand today's mechanism. So for SN1, we might have something like this, a tertiary alkyl halide, where the halogen carbon bond breaks, just because there might be enough thermal energy in solution for that to occur. If we used water as our solvent, it's reasonable that water could then come in and attack. After that attack, we are going to end up temporarily with a positively charged intermediate, which will deprotonate, leaving us an alcohol. Technically, there are two products that might form in this reaction, but since this is not a stereocenter, there is only one unique product that's going to be formed. Now, what is the starting material for today's experiment? Exactly the product of this reaction I just showed you. 2-methylbutane-2-ol, or also sometimes called T-pentyl alcohol. T-pentyl because it's a tertiary center with a 5-carbon compound. One of the reagents is concentrated hydrochloric acid. Now, alcohols are not terribly basic. They're kind of like water, actually, in terms of reactivity. Put a strong enough base in, you can force a hydrogen off. Put a strong enough acid in, you can force a hydrogen on. But since putting a hydrogen on does form a positively charged oxygen, it's a reaction that can easily reverse, which we haven't talked about reversible reactions because we haven't reviewed equilibrium yet. But in the last step of that SN1 reaction, notice that that deprotonation step is one of the key steps. Protonation is the key step in the reverse reaction. Technically, therefore, this is a reversible reaction, which is what that arrow I just wrote means. Do not confuse that with this kind of arrow. If you have one arrow that's got two heads on it, opposite directions, that's showing resonance structures. But a proper reversible arrow is where you use two lines, one pointed in one direction, one pointed in the other direction. In the future, for any new mechanism that I show you, once we've covered reversibility, and then this reaction, since it's new, I'll expect that you learn it here as well. But in any new reaction mechanism, if I show you reversible arrows, you need to know to use reversible arrows. If I don't, if I just write them one direction, then either it doesn't matter or the reaction's not reversible. So the SN1 mechanism, we'll come back to discuss whether it's reversible or not. For the moment, using just plain arrows is fine. For this reaction that we're now learning, since it is entirely true that that protonation is reversible, I now would like you to know it's reversible. And then Friday when we hit equilibrium, we'll talk about more what the implications of that are. So, proton hops on. Oxygen doesn't like a positive charge. Easy for the proton to hop back off. On, off, on, off, on, off. Eventually, it might come where instead of the hydrogen coming off to relieve that positive charge, the carbon-oxygen bond breaks instead. Now, since in the SN1 reaction, we see that an important step is that very attack of water on a carbocation, then technically water coming off, as I've shown this in real life, is a reversible process. You might already be asking yourself, okay, if this is reversible, then how the heck do we know that we're really going to form the product that we want to? Well, we can play tricks using Le Chatelier's principle. For example, if we constantly removed water as it formed, then it cannot come back and attack. Physically, the water will separate into a separate layer from your product, and so that physical separation will provide some way to help drive the reaction forward. Another facet of Le Chatelier's principle is that if you add a whole bunch of reagents, way excess of in terms of reagents than what you need, that can also push the reaction forward. We're flooding this stuff with concentrated hydrochloric acid. So because the water is going to separate somewhat, not be, even if you're physically mixing it, it's still going to be wanting to make its own separate layer. So that's going to help with the removal of water. And again, because we're flooding it with hydrogen chloride, we'll have an excess of chloride that will help push the reaction forward. So the last step is for chloride to come in and attack. Which, since this compound could now undergo an SN1 reaction, if the conditions were right, that's technically a reversible step as well. So notice, this is the exact reverse of an SN1 reaction, which when we tackle kinetics on Thursday, I'll refer to this again, when I talk about the principle of microscopic reversibility, that if one step in a forward direction is the most likely step of a reaction, that if that reaction reverses, it'll follow exactly that same step in reverse. Questions about this reaction mechanism? Yes?
You're saying forward, you have so many arrows up there, so
okay. This is the one just for today's reaction,
right.
And that's the SM1.
But it can flip-flop back and forth between those other two on the side, and you're saying that if we flood the system with HCl,
mm-hmm.
if that's the only product we're going to get.
Yes.
So when you're saying forward, you're saying you're going from the carbocation.
That forward means going this way, yes.
Does it have to go through the other steps in order to get there, or can it just go straight from the carbocation straight to that product?
Hydroxide would be a base if it tried to come off all by itself. And so it would be really reactive, and it wouldn't come off in the
place, and even if it did, it's much more basic than chloride and much more likely to attack that carbocation. So really, in actuality, it just never wants to come off by itself, which is why you need the acid to make this positively charged species, which much more easily comes off to form the carbocation. Now, how does the reaction work?
What do you do physically to make to perform the reaction? You are probably not old enough, any of you, to remember Shake and Bake, unless it still exists as a grocery product. Back in the 70s, they had this stuff called, I'm from the 70s, hello. That you could take some kind of either meat or vegetable, throw it in a bag that had spices, shake it up, throw it in the oven and bake it. So it was called Shake and Bake. That's pretty much like this reaction is, because you're going to take your alcohol, throw in the concentrated acid, well, not shake it at first. If you did do your pre-lab, you know that you're not supposed to cap and shake initially. But in the long run, that's all you do is shake the reaction, and magically you're going to get your product out. Now, let's review that a little more carefully, though, because when you first mix it, there is the possibility that you're going to get gas generated, most likely hydrogen chloride gas, which HCl, hydrochloric acid, you don't want to be breathing that in, so make sure that you're doing that in the fume hood. Don't do it out in the open laboratory. Once you've mixed it some, and whatever gas that's generated has the chance to escape, then you're supposed to cap, flip it open, shake, vent, just like we did in the very first experiment, the extraction experiment. When you turn it right side up again, the layers should separate out. And which one's going to be on top? The product, which is your alkyl halide, or the aqueous layer that had your hydrochloric acid in it? How could you test for it? Because if we looked it up in the text, the 2-chloro-2-methylbutane has a density of 0.866 grams per milliliter, which means it's less than water, which means the organic layer should float on top. But if we didn't know that value, how could we figure out which layer is which? Add some water to it. Why? What would happen? Or if you've kept it in the separatory funnel, we'll go to that bottom second layer. So yes, if the top layer was the aqueous layer and you drop some drops in, it'll just combine right away with that top layer because it's the aqueous layer. If instead the drops pass through and combine with the second layer, then you know that that bottom layer was the aqueous layer. That's what you should see today, because the organic layer will end up being your top layer. Yes? In this case, no, not really, because in order for the reaction to reverse, you'd need more exposures. You'd have to continue mixing. So if you were just adding a little bit of water, it shouldn't really throw it off, because if you think about it, if you've got 12 or 14 or whatever molar hydrochloric acid we've got, adding a few drops of water is not going to change that molarity significantly enough. So in other cases, you might be worried about doing something like that. This reaction, it shouldn't be a problem. So, to give you just a little smidge of terminology, this reaction is unusual because you're performing it neat. Which means you're performing it really without a solvent, because the alkyl halide will not dissolve in water. And so, kind of unusual. Generally, in order to worry about heat dissipation, or to worry about byproducts, you avoid using a very concentrated solution in your reactions. But because this kind of product formation, it's really the only product likely to form, that's why we can get away with it, especially on the small scale that we're performing this reaction. So you mix everything together, you carefully swirl it first, then you cap it, turn it over, shake, vent, shake, vent, shake, vent. Turn it back upside down, you get the two layers. Then what? There's a whole sequence, yes. And those are all called washes. So why is it called a wash? Because the entire time, your organic layer is going to stay in the separatory funnel. You're going to add something to it and then remove it again, leaving behind the organic layer each time. So it's not, it's kind of like extraction, but really you're kind of doing the reverse. You're trying to pull out water-soluble impurities from your organic layer and then get rid of those impurities. So you add your aqueous layer in, flip it over with the cap, shake, vent, turn it back over, get rid of the aqueous layer again. And that's what constitutes a wash. Would you like me to write down just a little miniature flow chart for that process? A diagram, yes. Organic layer is always, always, always in this lab going to be on the top because its density doesn't change, and water, it's always going to have a density greater than or equal to 1. Water itself is 1, solution's greater than 1. So here is that process. You start out first with just the organic layer in your separatory funnel. Which, let me talk a little bit about waste disposal. So for experiment 3, those of you who need to continue the SN1, SN2 experiment, you're still going to use the organic waste that's in the back of the room in H5. For today's experiment, since you're only getting rid of the aqueous layers, you're keeping the organic layers, you're only going to use the acid and base waste, which we still have in the back of the classroom here, kind of towards where the clock is. Since your first aqueous layer is that concentrated hydrochloric acid, you're going to dispose of it in the acidic waste, of course. Now let me write down the washes again. So first is that you add the wash. First, sodium chloride, second, sodium bicarbonate, third, water, and fourth, another sodium chloride. You only add one of them, though. You do not add all of them together. So if it says wash with sodium chloride and bicarbonate, that means do each one individually. Add it in, shake it up, drain it out, add the next wash in, shake it up, drain it out. So add one of your washes to the separatory funnel. You'll form two layers. Based on density and based on how this went with the other sections, I'll just say the organic layer is going to end up on top. So we have the aqueous layer on bottom. After you added the wash, shake and vent, and then drain and dispose of the aqueous layer. Now, what are the different washes and the order that you're doing them in? Well, let me preface this by saying this seems to be a kind of unusual sequence that's being used. I haven't figured out yet why you're starting with a sodium chloride wash. So I'm trying to find that out. Came up in yesterday's lab. Haven't found a good answer yet. Generally, what sodium chloride is used for is to increase the polarity of the aqueous layer. So particularly if you have your reaction mixture and it won't separate into layers. And this might actually happen today. And so maybe that's why you're using the sodium chloride first. Okay, that makes sense then. Sodium chloride, by increasing the polarity of that aqueous layer, is going to push out the organic layer even more so than water itself normally would. So it makes for a better separation between the organic and aqueous phases. And I bet you that's what's going on here, especially at our reduced quantities. Some of you might fail to get layers the first time around. So sodium chloride. Used to increase the polarity. Of the aqueous layer and separate it from the organic. If it's not being used to cause the separation, then it's being used to remove more polar impurities from the organic phase. Yes? Yes.
And then in the lab instruction, it said at the very end, after we distill it and get our product, it said it might be a really small amount or something like that.
Which, in fact, we're not even going to do the distillation, because since we're cutting the quantities down, this is very much like the microscale procedure. We're going to use macroscale glassware, but use the smaller quantities. And in that microscale procedure, you don't do a distillation. You just cross your fingers and hope the reaction went to completion, which we're going to be able to assess because the product of this we're going to be performing IR spectroscopy on. And so, in fact, if you look at on Thursday, the schedule, we're going to be starting IR spectroscopy. So we'll be able to verify if the reaction went to completion. But we're therefore not going to be doing distillation. Yes? If it originally called for 10, then only use 2. If you use a little bit more of the washes, won't really affect the products. It is true that water could react with the alkyl halide, but really you need much, much more time and heat than the brief exposure from any aqueous layer would cause. So after you do the sodium chloride, then you follow it up with sodium bicarbonate. Which, why do you think we're using a sodium bicarbonate wash? Well, if you had all this acid that was around, what if somehow you ended up with some acid getting into the organic layer, or if you had some kind of acidic byproduct? Well, if you hit it with sodium bicarbonate, you're going to remove any residual trace of acid then. And your products of that would just be carbonic acid, which decomposes into water and carbon dioxide, plus whatever counter ion, which should now be water soluble. So this is used to remove residual acid. Three, you're following up with a water wash, which water isn't doing anything magical except providing one more chance to remove aqueous soluble impurities. Which this is the part I'm most confused about, which is if you've already done a sodium chloride wash at the beginning, I'm not quite sure why it has you do one at the end. But until I can find out a better reason why not, I'd say go ahead and do that fourth sodium chloride wash. At the end of that wash, you should have your organic layer still in the separatory funnel. Drain that out, put it into a pear shape flask. This one's really starting to not annoy me, but confuse me, that I have to keep repeating this, that ground glass joints only work with other ground glass joints. Both sections, after I said that yesterday, I saw people trying to take a glass stopper and use it on an Erlenmeyer flask. That rough glass joint that you have on most of your glassware, it's milled so that those two joints will form a very good seal. If you don't have ground glass, if you just have a smooth piece of glassware, that will not form a seal This alkyl halide is volatile. You'll just not have any product left when you come back on Thursday. So do not use an Erlenmeyer flask to store, because I'm going to suggest even that you not use the rubber stoppers. Use a pear-shaped flask and use the ground glass stopper to stopper it with. Now, I'm hopefully said this during the first day when we checked in glassware, but in case I didn't, ground glass joints do have the possibility of freezing, which means they can get stuck sometimes. So there is grease over here that I recommend that you use. A little bit of this goes an awful long way. So if I were to squeeze out the amount of grease that I think you should use, and if you can't see from where you're sitting how much I've squeezed out, that's exactly the point. That's how small amount I want you to use. You get just a little tiny dab on your stopper itself, and put that stopper into the pear-shaped flask and twist it, and you can see the grease spreading around. You know that it's made a good seal, and that you'll be able to get it open again. After you've done that, if you wish to, it's not a bad idea to follow it up with parafilm. But if you use only parafilm, you're not going to have any product Thursday, almost guaranteed. Again, because these alkyl halides are volatile. So a greased up ground glass stopper followed by parafilm, and after that even, to make sure that that cap doesn't come off somehow, I'd use one of your Keck clips, which the narrow part of the Keck clip itself goes to the side where the stopper is. The larger part of that clip goes on the pear-shaped flask. And if you're not sure, then just come up and ask me, and I'll show you which way the clip should fit. Go ahead, and before you store it, put in the drying agent like it instructs you to. Please don't ask me how much drying agent, because I don't know. You do by using it. Remember what we did in the first lab, that if you add the drying agent and it clumps up, it means it's working. But if all you see is clumps, you don't know if you've added enough yet to know if you've got rid of all the water. So then you add a little more drying agent, and if that excess drying agent fails to clump up, you know that you've got rid of all the water. If in somehow transferring your layers, you can see two layers, then before you add the drying agent, pull the bottom layer out, because that means you've got some water that went wrong for the bride. And instead of having the drying agent try to remove it, if you can actually see the layer, why not use a pipette to get that water out? Question?
So we add the drying agent.
And then just store it that way, yes. Keep it over the drying agent, because if you have water in your product, it's going to show up on the IR spectrum the same way an alcohol would. We're going to talk about how IR can identify different functional groups. And so if you're trying to prove that we got rid of the alcohol, but if we have water around, it's going to confuse our results. So that's why you should go ahead and store it over the drying agent.